This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our discussion with American University professor, the historian Peter Kuznick. He directs the nuclear studies program at that institution. And today, we're probably closer to nuclear war than we've ever have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962.
We will also consider how to achieve world peace through law and the limits of the UN system, speaking with Professor James Ranney, who has written a provocative new book.
Professor Ranney is a UN legal consultant to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He gives us an insider perspective on world peace. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
If America's nuclear policy doesn't change immediately and rapidly, we're in a lot of trouble. 77 years ago, the USA became the first and so far the only country to use nuclear bombs when we destroyed the two Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to frighten the Russians and secure an immediate and unconditional surrender of Japan in World War II. The dropping of these bombs was the first move against Russia that would devolve 2 years later in 1947 into the Cold War. The threat of nuclear war has never eased. It's now imminent with the fighting in the Ukraine. We are now in a new stage of this war, which has become hot and so perilous it threatens all humanity, all Earth's creatures, with annihilation. What has been the history of attempts to contain and roll back the threat of nuclear war? What has been tried and what has failed? What will it take to get the 9 countries who possess nuclear weapons to give them up? The Veterans for Peace organization spelled it out. There should be no first-use policy, and nuclear missiles must be taken off hair-trigger alert. The USA should rejoin the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty, from which George W. Bush and Donald Trump withdrew. The USA should sign the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. Our country should initiate negotiations to reduce and eventually eliminate all nuclear weapons. To start, there must be a ceasefire in the Ukraine, the withdrawal of Russian forces, and guarantees be made for Ukrainian sovereignty and Russian security. We welcome back to continue our discussion with American University professor, the historian Peter Kuznick. He directs the nuclear studies program at that institution. Professor Kuznick and Oliver Stone wrote the book, The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you, Michael.
Peter, isn't it alarmist for me to say that the war in the Ukraine presents the greatest threat of nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962? The late great historian Martin Sherwin wrote in his last and just published book, Gambling with Armageddon, about the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we escaped nuclear annihilation by good leadership and dumb luck. Was Sherwin correct?
Well, you know, that's a timely question for me, because I just got back from memorial service for Marty Sherwin. That's a sad day. I mean, it's been several months since Marty passed away, but he was perhaps America's greatest nuclear historian. He wrote 3 fabulous books. His first one, World Destroyed, was about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How that led to the Cold War in part. His second one, American Prometheus, which he co-authored with Kai Bird, the biography of Robert Oppenheimer, won the Pulitzer Prize. And his third book that you just mentioned, Gambling with Armageddon, is the definitive work on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And people have told him not to do it because there's been so much written about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but this one really blazes new ground in a very, very important way. So So I think, yes, we did survive the Cuban Missile Crisis by a combination of statesmanship and good luck. Without good luck, the statesmanship would have been meaningless. This is the closest we've come in almost 60 years now since the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, closest we've come to nuclear war. It's a very, very frightening situation. And we need Marty's voice, because he was a very wise spokesperson on the question of nuclear weapons, nuclear history, and nuclear war, and the dangers we're in. So I wish we had Marty here to help us through this crisis the way he's helped us through some of the others.
What did he mean by luck?
Well, what Kennedy and Khrushchev both discovered during the course of the crisis is that they had lost control. Khrushchev did not order the ground forces to shoot down the U-2 plane, the American spy plane. The Americans did not know that Russian... they didn't know a lot of things. They didn't know that the nuclear weapons were in place, that they all had discovered, I think it was 33 of the 42 missiles that the Soviets had put in Cuba. They didn't know where the other ones were. They didn't know that there were battlefield nuclear weapons. And initially, the idea was that the Americans, if we invaded, the Joint Chiefs were calling for a U.S. invasion. And many times, the only one in the room who was resisting that was John Kennedy himself. Robert Kennedy presents a kind of apocryphal version of events in his book 13 Days, which people have thought was the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis for a long time, in which he elevates his own role as a peacemaker, make it look like he stood with his brother. In fact, during much of this situation, he was with the Hawks, and the Joint Chiefs were calling for bombing the missile sites, followed by a full-fledged U.S. invasion to overthrow the Castro government. And the U.S. assessment was that if that took place, with all of the sorties and all of the U.S. troops who were marshaled to do that, we'd be 1,800 casualties, 18,000 casualties, and 2,500 deaths. When we later learned, and we were assuming that there were 10,000 armed Soviets and 100,000 armed Cuban troops, we later find out that there are 42,000 armed Soviets and 250,000 Cuban troops there. When McNamara found that out, he says that we would have lost 25,000 in the invasion. It was 30 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis that McNamara found out for the first time that there were also 100 battlefield nuclear weapons in Cuba that would very likely have been used. At that point, McNamara turned white, and he said, in that case, we would have lost 100,000 U.S. troops. We would have definitely wiped out Cuba, and almost certainly there would have been nuclear war with the Soviet Union. So that's how close we came, because we miscalculated. Our intelligence was bad. There was also the incident which Arthur Schlesinger, the Kennedy administration historian, a very good Harvard historian, later City University historian, said that was not only the most dangerous moment in the Cold War, it was the most dangerous moment in human history. And that's when one of the U.S. Destroyers was dropping depth charges on a submerged Soviet sub, and they knocked out the electricity. Carbon dioxide levels were going through the roof. People were passing out. The temperatures were rising, and the officer in charge gave the order to arm the nuclear torpedo. The U.S. had no idea there were nuclear weapons aboard that sub, and the captain of the sub, the commander, says, "We're down here doing somersaults while the war has probably started up there." He couldn't reach the Kremlin. He couldn't reach the the top staff. And so he gave the order, said, we're not going to die in disgrace. We'll at least redeem ourselves and launch the nuclear torpedo. That would have taken out the American fleet, and that would have started World War III right there. But the other commander, a man named Arkhipov, who on the ground was actually above the commander, but on the ship was subordinate, he talked the first commander down and convinced him not to launch nuclear weapons. That's how close we came. So the intelligence was bad, the command and control was bad, the situation was out of control, and what Kennedy and Khrushchev both understood was that they had lost control and that they would survive this by really blind luck, much more than statesmanship, much more than wisdom. Even though Kennedy and Khrushchev were doing everything they could once the crisis began to unravel to avoid nuclear war and avoid World War III, they both realized they lost control of the situation. And what they both realized is that when these crises develop, it's impossible to maintain control. So after the crisis was over, Khrushchev writes a remarkable letter to Kennedy, in which he says, from evil some good must come. The people of our countries have felt the burning flames of thermonuclear war unlike anything they have ever experienced. What we need to do now is work together to eliminate any conflict between us that could cause another crisis. And for the next year, Kennedy and Khrushchev worked together to try to do just that. And they passed the arms control treaty, the atmospheric arms control treaty, nuclear ban treaty, that stopped atmospheric nuclear testing. They talked about joint space exploration, rather than this being a competition, making it a collaboration. Kennedy talked about defusing the crisis in Vietnam, like they had done previously in Laos, by neutralizing the country. Kennedy talked to a lot of people about his plans to withdraw from Vietnam as soon as he got reelected. There was situation after situation that they were going to defuse the tensions. But unfortunately for humanity, Kennedy was assassinated in November of 1963, and Khrushchev was ousted from office the next year. And so we didn't get our opportunity to dial back the Cold War, to end the Cold War, and to end the nuclear arms race, which should have happened originally. Had Henry Wallace become president in 1945 instead of Harry Truman, there would have been no nuclear arms race, no atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and almost certainly no Cold War. And Wallace, who's been lost to history, was Roosevelt's vice president from 41 to 45. Wallace was the second most popular man in America. On the day the Democratic Party convention began, July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll asking potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% of potential voters said they wanted Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. Truman was a non-entity, but the party bosses controlled the convention. And although had Claude Pepper gotten 5 more feet to the microphone and gotten Wallace's name and nomination that first night, if he had done so, Wallace would have been back on the ticket and the world would have been different. Unfortunately, they adjourned the convention before there was a chance to vote. And Truman, on the third ballot, finally the next day, gets the nomination.
Yeah, that's quite a dramatic story, Peter. I read that story in your book, The Untold History of the United States, which you wrote with Oliver Stone, and I would recommend it to our listeners. But let's talk about the concept of lost control as it relates to what's going on now in the Ukraine. How would you assess the danger level there? What developments in the war, militarily and politically, would be most likely to cause Putin to use his nukes or the United States to respond in a nuclear fashion? Is the nuclear arsenal that the Russians have even larger than the United States? What's the danger?
Well, the Russian nuclear arsenal actually is a little bigger than the United States. They've got about 6,000 nuclear weapons. The U.S. has about 5,500. The Russians also have about 2,000 battlefield nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, the Americans only have 100 or so, although Trump and Biden are replenishing our supply. The possibility of this becoming a nuclear war was very real from the start, which is why so many of us did everything we could to try to resolve this conflict without going to war, and why so many of us are so angry with Putin for bringing us to this very dangerous situation. And from the very beginning, Putin was making nuclear threats. He said, whoever tries to hinder us, and even more so, to create threats to our country, to our people, should know that Russia's response will be immediate, and it will lead you to such consequences that you have never encountered in your history. So he's making nuclear threats from the beginning. A week or 10 days ago now, UN Secretary General Guterres said, quote, the prospect of nuclear conflict, once unthinkable, is now back within the realm of possibility. And Dmitry Peskin, the Russian spokesperson, a couple of days ago, said that there really is a threat, that if Russia faces an existential threat, then he says they could use nuclear weapons. He says then it can be possible to use nuclear weapons. Putin has put Russia's nuclear weapons on high alert, which means they're being ready to be used. And if Russia is further backed into a corner here, there is a real chance that Russia will use nuclear weapons. We also know that the danger of war between Russia and NATO is real. Russia attacked that base west of Lviv that was 15 miles from the Polish border. We know that Russia is intent upon interdicting those supply lines from Romania, from Poland, into Ukraine. The chances of accidental or deliberate use of nuclear weapons is too close for it to be tolerated. Because, as we know, using nuclear weapons raises the possibility of escalation, the certainty of escalation, and the real possibility of all-out nuclear war. We don't need an all-out nuclear war to create catastrophic circumstances on the Earth. The latest research by the scientists shows that even a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, would cause a partial nuclear winter. What would happen is the cities would burn, the smoke, soot, and debris would go into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere. Within 2 weeks, it would circle the Earth. They would block the sun's rays from penetrating to the Earth's surface. Temperatures on the Earth's surface would plummet to freezing. Much of global agriculture would be destroyed. And that limited nuclear war with 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons could result in the deaths of up to 2 billion people. Well, we don't want to have 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. We've got 13,000. And they're not Hiroshima-sized. They're between 7 and 70 times, most of them, the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So do the math, and you realize how crazy it is for us to be engaging in another nuclear confrontation. Even if it's 10% or 5% chance, that is gambling with the future of life on our planet. 5% is so far out of line with what human beings should rationally tolerate that we're in a very, very, very dangerous predicament right now.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Kuznick, who directs the Nuclear Studies Program at American University. Peter, on January 22nd, the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force, becoming international law. Nuclear weapons are now unlawful to possess, develop, deploy, test, or use or threaten to use. Of course, in the past, there were attempts by nuclear nations to either eliminate nuclear weapons or at least contain and roll back the threat of nuclear war. How would you assess the effectiveness of those past attempts?
Well, we could say we've been lucky so far, and we're still here to talk about it. If your guests have a chance to watch the extraordinary 1959 movie On the Beach, in which they're in the aftermath of an all-out nuclear war. The radiation is spreading around the globe, and the last place where there's still humans alive is in Melbourne, Australia, the southernmost major city on the planet. And they're waiting for their deaths because they're going to be eliminated also because of radiation poisoning. But there are rallies downtown in which they're singing Onward Christian Soldiers, and there's a banner there that flies in this across the rally. It says, "There's still time, brother." And you see them at the rally and with the banner waving. At the end of the movie, when there's nobody left, you see the banner waving again. And it's too late now. While we're still here, there is still time. And that's the thing about deterrence theory. Deterrence theory works to the point where it stops working. And then there's nobody left to tell them that they were wrong. That's the theme of the nuclear age. We still have time. We still know the situation we face. We lack the will. We lack the wisdom to do what's necessary, which is to eliminate nuclear weapons before it's too late, not after it's too late. And so we're in a very, very, very dangerous situation right now, especially because the Russians say if they face an existential threat as a country, they will use their nuclear weapons. There's some debate about it in the United States, but there is a strong belief that Russia's new nuclear doctrine is called escalate to de-escalate. That's one part of it. And that means that if Russia needs it to deal with a precarious situation, they believe that they can use nuclear weapons, and that'll signal how serious they are about the situation, and the other side will back down, and then they can de-escalate. Well, we know from a lot of war games we've done over the years, the prospect of limited nuclear war is very faint at best. In war game after war game, which they've tried to do that, there's no stop point. So let's say the Russians hit us, and we retaliate and hit them, and then they come back and hit us again, and we hit them. I mean, it just keeps on going. In these war games, they cannot find a way to end it, to actually have a limited nuclear war. So we've been talking about this for a long time, but the reality is that there's a very, very serious risk that this would escalate into a full-scale nuclear war. And if that happens, then there's nobody left to pick up the pieces, nobody left to bury the dead, nobody left to tell those MFing generals that they were wrong about deterrence theory and the value of their huge nuclear arsenals. Now, on the one hand, we have reduced them, right? I take students every summer on a study abroad class in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And year after year, I would take my students to the Atomic Bomb Museum in Hiroshima, and I'd write down the same information from one of the exhibits, that by 1985, the world had accumulated the equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. What we would need, 1.47 million, for is beyond anybody's comprehension. We don't know how many times you've got to be able to kill everybody on the planet before these war planners are satisfied. But that was the case. And we had between 65 and 70,000 nuclear weapons at the time. Now we're down to 14,000. Now we're down to 20% of what we had. So maybe instead of killing everybody on the planet 10 times over, we can only do it two or three times. But that's enough death for me.
Does the new UN treaty ruling out nuclear weapons give you new hope, Peter? And if so, what do you think would be the best way, the best process to follow in order to finally abolish nuclear weapons or vastly diminish the numbers and types of nuclear weapons in the world?
Well, Michael, unfortunately, the new nuclear ban treaty, which went into effect last January, a year ago, does not cover the nuclear nations. It only covers nations that are part of it. And so I think, what is it, 55 nations now, maybe 57, 58, have signed on and ratified the treaty. Trump did everything he could to convince countries, to pressure countries, to coerce countries to not sign. they did it anyway. Clearly, the will of the people on the earth, all of whom will perish if there's a nuclear war, even though it's got nothing to do with their countries, the will of the people on the earth is to banish nuclear weapons once and for all. But the treaty doesn't apply to the 9 nuclear powers. And so that's the problem. It's a great treaty in principle, but even the non-proliferation treaty was a great treaty in principle, although it might be unfair. According to the non-proliferation treaty, the nuclear powers, as of 1970, the 5 nuclear powers were committed to getting rid of their nuclear arsenals. That hasn't worked either. So the United States and the others are all in breach of that treaty, first of all. They haven't signed on to the TPNW, the current nuclear ban treaty. And it doesn't just call for banning nuclear weapons. It calls for banning nuclear testing. It calls for making any kind of nuclear threat illegal. So whenever Biden or Trump or Obama or Bush or any of the other presidents said that all options are on the table, that's committing a crime against the threat of use of nuclear weapons. And that's still the case now. So even though all eyes are now are focused on Putin and what Putin's going to do, and the reason why people are so worried is Putin sounds so deranged, sounds so unhinged. The things he's been saying for the past 5 weeks make one wonder, what is his grasp on reality? And we don't know. And so the fact that a man who's got a tenuous grasp on reality has got 6,000 nuclear weapons at his disposal, that's a very, very terrifying prospect. And so we don't know what Putin's capable of. Is he acting crazy to convince the West to back down the way Richard Nixon said about his madman thesis? He says, well, just let we'll get word to the Vietnamese that Richard Nixon, you know, he's obsessed with communism, and he's going to do anything he can to defeat it, and he's got his finger on the nuclear button. And Nixon says, you let the Vietnamese know that, and Ho Chi Minh will be in Paris within 48 hours to negotiate with us on our terms. Well, that didn't work for Nixon, and we don't know if that's what Putin is up to or if he really believes the things he's saying and doing, which in some ways is even more frightening.
Yeah, really. Peter, we've only got another few minutes left. I wanted to ask you about the role that the military-industrial complex, with its weapons manufacturers' seemingly unquenchable thirst for more and more profits, what role do they play in the world that has really not ridden itself of the nuclear weapons that they have?
You remember the great Bob Dylan song, Masters of War?
I do.
It's his angriest, most passionate, hardest-hitting song. The young Bob Dylan had a few. One that he never officially recorded on an album was Let Me Die in My Footsteps Before I Go Down Under the Ground into a Fallout Shelter, written about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Hard rain's gonna fall. Dylan was very sensitive to those issues. And in Masters of War, he really, really eviscerates these arms manufacturers. During World War One, after World War One, the arms manufacturers who made enormous profits were called merchants of death. And that's what we should call them. We shouldn't dignify them by calling them defense contractors. They're merchants of death. Every time a bomb kills people, they make money. You hear the cash register going off. Every time a missile is fired, they make money. They profit in death. And Lockheed Martin, for example, stock shares have gone up 25% since the start of the year. I mean, these are people. In 19, there were the Nye Committee hearings in the U.S. Senate in 1930, I think it was 34, 35, in which the senators were calling for the elimination of all profits for war manufacturers the first day a new war is declared. They wanted to tax the profits 99%. Or eliminate them completely, nationalize the defense industry. The fact that these, I don't know what word to use that I can use on the air, the fact that they are lobbying for war, that they're lobbying for more defense spending. Who's going to profit from Putin's war in Ukraine? Certainly not Russia, certainly not Ukraine, but the merchants of death. And we see now with the expansion of NATO, we see now with increased military budgets all over the planet, we see now that all of our efforts at nuclear disarmament are being laughed out the window now. Countries are talking about the need to develop nuclear weapons. Former Prime Minister Abe in Japan is saying that Japan, the country that was bombed by America's nuclear weapons, the most anti-nuclear country in the world, needs to have nuclear sharing with the United States so they can get their own nuclear weapons. South Korea, more than 60% of the South Koreans want South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. What Kim Jong-un and what the North Koreans understand is the importance of nuclear weapons. The North Korean press, when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, the North Koreans said the one mistake Saddam Hussein made was not to have nuclear weapons. If they had nuclear weapons, the United States would not have been able to invade. And that's a lesson that, sadly, that Ukraine has drawn in part. Why they needed NATO membership, why they needed nuclear weapons, or at least a nuclear umbrella. And the tragic thing about it is that these countries that want it are right. From the standpoint of the interests of humanity, the worst thing that could possibly happen is to spread nuclear weapons. But from the local standpoint of defense of these countries, I understand why they want them. I think it's insane. I think it's going to make the world that much more dangerous and get us that much closer to Armageddon. But I can understand from a very nationalist parochial perspective why they want them. But I don't look at it from the nationalist parochial perspective. I look at it from the standpoint of the future of life on our planet. And I know that we absolutely must do everything we can to abolish nuclear weapons immediately. It is just too dangerous, too reckless, too out of control.
Thank you, Peter Kuznick. We have come, unfortunately, to the end of our allotted time. Peter, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I suggest that they get my last article from last week that I published in Strategic Statecraft, the publication of the Quincy Institute, and it's about Xi Jinping and why Xi Jinping has got to, it's in China's absolute interest as well as Russia's interest for him to force Putin to negotiate immediately, and that he's got the leverage to do it. I've got my website up at American University. They can watch my documentary series with Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States, 12 parts. I was on Showtime and all over the world. They should read our updated version of the Untold History of the United States book, which is now over 900 pages. The graphic novel will be out later this year. It's out in young readers' books, in abbreviated editions, lots of ways they can follow it. But I also am doing several interviews a day about the Ukraine situation, so they can follow them all over the world. Unfortunately, not on mainstream media in the United States, because people with my views, people that are critical of American empire, critical of the arms race, really anti-war, don't get to be on mainstream media. You have to be a general, you have to be in the intelligence community, you have to be part of the blob, a policymaker, but you can get contrary opinions in many places, and they can email me at kuznick@american.edu.
That's KUZNICK. Peter Kuznick, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And please come back when the new books come out. We'd love to talk to you again. We really appreciate your good work. Thank you again. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I will not go down under the ground, 'cause somebody tells me that death's coming around. And I will not carry myself down to die. When I go to my grave, my head will be high. Let me die in my footsteps before I go down under the ground. could have been. The meaning of life has been lost in the wind. Here's some people thinking that the end is close by. Instead of learning to live, they are learning to die. Let me die in my footsteps before I go down.
In 1945, following World War I and World War II, wars that claimed millions of lives, the nations of the world enacted the United Nations Charter to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. The Charter prohibits the use of military force except in self-defense after an armed attack by another state or when the Security Council approves it. The five victors of World War II, who became the permanent members of the Security Council, agreed to the Charter because they each received a veto over matters of war and peace. The United States is a party to the 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Nevertheless, it continues to violate the provision of that treaty that requires the parties to move toward the elimination of nuclear weapons. Although he won the Nobel Peace Prize, Barack Obama's administration advanced a policy, which Donald Trump and Joe Biden continued, to develop leaner and meaner nuclear weapons. The proposed U.S. budget calls for nearly $2 trillion over the next 30 years to build two new bomb factories, missiles, planes, submarines, and redesigned warheads. In spite of the UN Charter and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, we are now facing the most dangerous threat of nuclear war in the last 60 years. James Ranney is a retired adjunct professor at Widener Law School, co-founder of the Jeanette Rankin Peace Center, a legal consultant to the UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and a board member of the Project for Nuclear Awareness. Professor Ranney has written a book called World Peace Through Law, Replacing War with the Global Rule of Law. In this book, he calls for arms reduction, including the abolition of nuclear weapons, and global alternative dispute resolution mechanisms with enforcement mechanisms. We are lucky to have Professor Ranney with us today to discuss his hopeful, if not idealistic, theory of how to achieve world peace. James Ranney, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you very much.
Russia is committing aggression in Ukraine, and we are closer to nuclear war now than at any time in the past 60 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why has the United Nations Charter been unsuccessful in preventing wars?
I'd say that the primary reason is because there's no provision for what I call compulsory international dispute resolution. It was in, by the way, the original draft, but it got eliminated. And so basically the UN has been well recognized for decades as being defective in that respect, primarily because of the veto in the Security Council. So that's my short answer, I guess.
The U.S. continues to violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it's pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Jim, what makes you think the U.S. and Russia, which together control 90% of all nuclear warheads, would agree to nuclear disarmament?
Primarily because those who have looked at the issue longest and most carefully have all unanimously come around to the conclusion that it's a good idea. I'm thinking, for instance, that even Paul Nitze, who was one of the early gurus of nuclear deterrence and drafted the original SEOP, Strategic Integrated Operational Plan for the use of nukes, when he was 93 years old, he finally came to the conclusion, this way lies Thanatos, certain death. And so people like the Four Horsemen, William Perry, and Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, and the fourth person whose name I'm forgetting, all in their unanimous article in the Wall Street Journal,
They similarly have argued against nuclear weapons. Less well known, by the way, George H.W. Bush authored an article, a little letter, which he didn't make very public, in which he said he agreed with these four horsemen. George Shultz, I forgot him. How could I forget him? By the way, George Shultz, I called his office down in Houston, and I was working on my book because I'd seen a quote somewhere years ago in which he had said, in response to the proposal to abolish nuclear weapons made by Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan up at Reykjavik, the conservatives attacked, and how could that possibly have been thought of? And the response that was given by George Shultz at that time was, what's so great about a world that could be ended in 30 minutes? So when I called his office and spoke with his assistant, I asked what the source of that was, because I couldn't find it anywhere in the literature. She said she checked with George Shultz, and she said he was merely repeating what he heard President Reagan himself say a dozen times. So you have all these figures that are listed in my book at page 44 on the first page of the chapter dealing with abolition of nuclear weapons. You have a list of generals and admirals and Robert McNamara and Colin Powell and George Kennan who've all favored abolition. And in fact, recent polls of the American public have shown that over 80% of the American public favors unanimous abolition. So I think it's absolutely going to happen, in my opinion. But it's just, right now it seems like it's impossible, and that's just the way it always goes. So I guess that's my answer.
The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons prohibits the transfer, use, or threat to use nuclear weapons or nuclear explosive devices. States party to the treaty pledge never, under any circumstances, to develop, test, produce, manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess, or stockpile nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. But the five original nuclear-armed countries, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and China, are not parties to the treaty. How do you propose getting them on board?
Well, I guess primarily it would be the primary mode of social change that I posit in my book, which is a single word, education. There was a former colleague of mine who sent me an early draft of a speech in which he said people ask him what can they do that would be practical to help make the world safer, more peaceful, etc. What can they possibly do? And his response was as follows. He said, in order to secure a safe world and abolish nuclear weapons, we will need fundamental social and political change. Fundamental social and political change requires attitudinal change. And attitudinal change requires education. Educating ourselves, first of all, and then educating others. And perhaps later in the interview, I can enumerate some of the few books that I recommend most out of the probably 4,000 or 5,000 books that I've now read on the peace issue.
And Jim, nuclear weapons means lots of profits in the coffers of big defense contractors, doesn't it?
Yeah, in fact, I kind of slide over that issue in my book. I have a footnote where I talk about some of the proposals that have been made over the years. And I think, you know, one thing is going to be what's already been happening, which is an economic boycott of those firms that are involved in the nuclear arms industry. I think that can be pretty significant. But other than that, I'm not too radical about it all.
What are the limitations of the UN's judicial arm, the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court? And what is the U.S. posture vis-a-vis that court?
Well, both the U.S. and the USSR, the former USSR, do not accept the compulsory jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. And so that makes it a particularly weak arm, something that was not envisioned by the drafters of the court. And in fact, I'll mention as a parenthetical, there is a decision that the ICJ just made at about on March 16th that was based not on the general compulsory jurisdiction provisions, but in the old provisions in the old Geneva Conventions dealing with genocide. And what they said was that they had jurisdiction to hear the case because of Putin's lying statement that the Ukrainians had engaged in genocide. And so, as an initial matter, they found in a preliminary ruling that there was no genocide, and therefore they had jurisdiction to order the halt of what the Russians were doing in Ukraine. And, of course, it's probably not going to be very effective. As to what I think should be effective, by the way, what should happen, I think that what we need is perhaps a UN General Assembly resolution, even though the UN General Assembly typically has no particular responsibility for national security matters. I think that if they had a resolution that urged the Putin to stop this war and engage in international dispute resolution mechanisms, that might be what's needed.
Yes, the General Assembly did, once the Security Council was deadlocked because of the veto of Russia over the Security Council resolution demanding that Russia pull out of Ukraine, the General Assembly met under the Uniting for Peace resolution and did pass a resolution overwhelmingly because, of course, the General Assembly is the democratic body of the UN and Russia doesn't have a veto there, demanding that Russia pull out. Jim, you advocate replacing the use of international force with the global rule of law. What are the main points of your program?
Primarily, what I focus upon is what I call compulsory international dispute resolution. And I'll get back to that in just a moment and try and unpack that a bit. I think it would need to be preceded by certain arms reductions, including abolition of nuclear weapons and concomitant balanced reductions in conventional forces. And then I think also that compulsory international dispute resolution would need to be backed up by a UN peace force, although it wouldn't necessarily require that. According to one of the authors that I cite, once you had the party's agreement to submit to the jurisdiction of the court, that might be all you really need. But I want to get to the crux of my argument for compulsory international dispute resolution. The argument is simplicity itself and starts from the premise that we need to abolish war. That's already been agreed to by Reagan and Gorbachev in 1985. They say that nuclear war can never be fought and can never be won and must never be fought. And secondly, that means that we need, obviously, alternatives to war. And that in turn means that we need international alternative dispute resolution. And finally, that means, in my opinion, that we need compulsory international dispute resolution, which leads to the question, of course, what would make it compulsory? And if I may, I'll address that right now. In addition to a treaty making it so, an increasingly strong international norm, N-O-R-M, making it so. And so what would create that international norm? Well, there's nothing that guarantees it. But the French political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville said in his famous book, Democracy in America, this about norms, quote, "I am convinced that the happiest situation and the best laws cannot maintain a constitution despite norms, whereas the latter, norms, turn even the most unfavorable position and the worst laws to good account." And again, how will this occur? Again, by model of social change, of the importance of education. And so it's a long and involved process, but it's a moderate proposal. Number one, we propose arms reductions, not, as some would urge, general and complete disarmament. Number two, we urge compulsory international dispute resolution, not world federalism, which is probably unacceptable. And thirdly, we propose a UN peace force, not pacifism, as the pacifists would urge. So in short, it's a very modern proposal. It's been accepted by five American presidents in the past, starting with Ulysses S. Grant, running up to Teddy Roosevelt in his famous acceptance speech of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1910, William Howard Taft, John F. Kennedy, and Dwight David Eisenhower. So it's nothing new. I can't pretend that I made it up, but it has been forgotten for about 60 years.
Jim, can you please explain your four-stage process for negotiation and arbitration by the World Court?
Absolutely. Compulsory negotiation, which would have probably prevented World War I, according to two historians, is obviously something not to be forgotten. It would be followed as a backup by compulsory mediation, which would probably solve the vast majority of all international conflict. By the way, Hitler, prior to invading Poland on September 1st, 1939, said the following, quote, "I just hope some Schweinhund does not suggest mediation." So the fact that Hitler feared mediation, I think, is a strong argument in his favor. Mediation would be followed by arbitration. And by the way, I've done hundreds of arbitrations and mediations in our domestic court system, so I know a little bit about how it works. But arbitration is more intrusive, but it's been proposed by the American presidents Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, but ended up being rejected by the Republicans in the Senate. And the final stage is the compulsory adjudication in the World Court, as proposed under both Dwight David Eisenhower and under the Kennedy administration in the famous McCloy-Zorin Agreement of 1961. And it was also proposed subsequently in 1987 by Mikhail Gorbachev, a fact that was noted in not a single American newspaper. It was noted in one British newspaper, and it's noted in a book that I happen to have in my library. So those are the four stages. They would not necessarily have to be held in rigid sequence. The parties could have a lot of flexibility. One of the proposals that I talk about in my book is what's called advisory arbitration, which would be an ideal prelude to mediation. Advisory arbitration would show the parties how this panel is likely to, you know, resolve the case, but it would be only advisory and followed up, as I said, by mediation. I think that would be extremely effective in the international venue.
We're speaking today with Professor James Ranney, who has written a provocative book called World Peace Through Law, Replacing War with the Global Rule of Law. How do you envision a United Nations peace force, and how would it work?
Well, I have a whole chapter of my book dealing with it, and it's a chapter that I'm sort of least confident of. The only thing that's good news about it is that it may be totally unnecessary to have a substantial peace force. It certainly wouldn't require a huge army. It would not entail the use of nuclear weapons. I think that in 98 or 99% of the cases, you would not need resort to a UN peace force.
And despite those limitations, what are the major obstacles to a UN peace force?
Well, there's a whole Chapter 11 there. I deal with objections, and the primary objection being that it just would not hold together when push came to shove. And so what I do is I look at specific prior historical conflicts, including World War I and World War II and the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on, and certain pending crises, including that in Ukraine. And I cite, in regard to Ukraine, by the way, a local professor here at Arcadia University who is born in Ukraine, and she had a small article that got published in a newsletter up there saying that it was an ideal situation for compulsory negotiation, and that there were areas in which negotiation might be very appropriate. By the way, in my own thinking about Ukraine, as I've watched, I have it on right now on TV and with no sound, I keep thinking of what might work, and I have, over time, changed my thinking somewhat. Not that it would depend on me. It would depend upon what the parties themselves are able to agree to, and who knows what that might be. But I do think that, that Putin's illegal and aggressive war has changed the posture of what he might have reasonably asked for under, under mediation or negotiation. He may be entitled to virtually nothing, maybe a land-year lease on Crimea or something like that. But in any event, that's just a quick comment on the Ukraine situation, which is obviously current interest.
Jim, what is the mobilization of shame, and has it worked anywhere?
Well, you know, I think that this very war in Ukraine is having quite an impact on reinforcing certain UN charter norms against aggression. People are seeing war is not such a good thing. War is bad. And I think this is reinforcing that. And I think that the unanimity of the opposition to Putin, their vote on that proposal you talked about was 141-5. And so that's a pretty amazing vote in the UN. I think that there's a gradual reinforcement of international norms against aggression.
Jim, why didn't the mobilization of shame kick in and people around the world become outraged when George W. Bush invaded Iraq, when Bill Clinton invaded Yugoslavia, when Obama invaded Libya?
Well, those are all good questions, as we say, when we don't want to answer, give the answer. I guess that sufficient norms against this kind of aggression just aren't strong enough at this point. But again, the very war that we're looking at right now in Ukraine, I think, is going to increase that. I was one of those, by the way, who marched with a little pathetic homemade sign against Bush's illegal Iraq War II, we call it. And so, not that it obviously did any good. I think gradually we're going to come to a more peaceful, more just world.
Well, thank you so much, Professor James Ranney, author of the book World Peace Through Law, Replacing War with the Global Rule of Law.
And thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.